Welcome to the Confluence Investment Management Biweekly Geopolitical Report for January 13th, 2025. I'm Phil Adler. The regime change in Syria has sent shockwaves across the Middle East. Confluence Associate Market Strategist Daniel Ortworth joins us today to look at what might be going on beneath the surface and help investors understand the potential impact on portfolios. Daniel, before we get to investment strategy, a short history lesson might be in order. Now, Syria is one of those countries created with artificial boundaries after World War I with little regard, maybe no regard, to natural, ethnic, and religious divisions. What stands out to you about Syria's history of country alliances?
Happy New Year, Phil. It's good to be back. A review of Syrian history shows that the area has rarely enjoyed its own independence. It has usually been either the province of another empire or a client state heavily dependent on the patronage of some larger power. For 400 years, from the early 1500s until World War I, Syria was a province of the Ottoman Empire based in modern-day Turkey just to its north. By the time of World War I, while the Ottoman Empire had become very weak, European powers led by Britain and France had gained valuable economic interests in the region. During the war, they crafted a secret agreement to divide parts of the dying Ottoman Empire into their own spheres of influence based on their own interests without regard to local culture or ethnic boundaries. Syria, as we now know it, was one of those areas, marked off for the French. These new boundaries survived World War II, and before anyone could consider rectifying the situation, the Cold War became the new dominant force across the globe and in every region, with the United States and the Soviet Union striving to gain influence and develop alliances wherever they could. In the Middle East, Syria fell into the Soviet orbit. The Soviets provided extensive aid, and for that price, they gained the staunch loyalty of Syria's new, highly dependent government. In turn, the Syrian government, which eventually fell under the sway of a dictator named Hafez Assad, used Soviet aid to turn Syria into a police state over which he had absolute control. After the Soviet collapse and the end of the Cold War, the Assads took advantage of cultural and religious affiliations with the relatively young, at that time, theocratic regime in Iran to acquire for itself a new patron. For the last three decades, Iran held tight influence over Syria, and the Assad regime continued to use this patronage to maintain control.
Well, the prevailing theory about the regime change seems to be that Syria's government fell because longtime allies, Iran and Russia, reduced their support and diverted their attention to other needs. But they couldn't have expected Syria's government to collapse. What might this tell us about the state of affairs within Iran and Russia?
Phil, it tells us just how completely preoccupied Iran and Russia are with their own troubles. We can be confident that neither Russia nor Iran stopped valuing or caring about the important role played by the Assad regime in their Middle Eastern geopolitical strategies. It is true that Assad had recently been acting in ways that ran counter to Russian and Iranian prerogatives, most conspicuously Assad's diplomatic overtures to Iran's arch-rival Saudi Arabia. Still, even with these irritants, the Assad regime played a valuable role for both of them. Simply put, Iran is beset with major problems in its conflict with Israel and the consequences of that, and Russia is up to its neck in the war with Ukraine. They cannot as easily afford to support their clients, and in this case, they overestimated their clients' ability to stand on its own for a little while.
Now, would you say, Daniel, that Syria's value in the eyes of other countries has more to do with geography than wealth?
Yes, Phil, I think that's a fair statement. Historically, Syria has not boasted a major economy. For example, with an economy about the size of Zimbabwe, a tiny poor country in Africa, Syria's economy is about 13% the size of Israel's and only about 2% the size of Turkey's economy. Its domestic consumer market is small, and it does not produce goods or services that are hotly demanded in other markets. On that note, despite residing in a region awash with oil and populated by major oil producers, think of Iran and Saudi Arabia and the rest, Syria produces a negligible amount of oil and exports even less. Rather, Syria's value to larger regional and global players comes from its location. It serves as a key east-west linkage between Iran and its proxies in the Mediterranean Sea area, and as a north-south linkage between Turkey and the Arabian Peninsula. For global players, its central position amidst other countries can serve as a base for operations and influence throughout the surroundings.
Well, what have we learned about the way the new government in Syria will operate by looking at their actions so far?
The first thing that seems quite clear is that its foundational loyalties and alignments will go the opposite direction of its predecessor. The Assad regime came from the Alawite sect, which incidentally comprises only about 10% of the Syrian population and is a religious offshoot of Shia Islam. Since Iran is the dominant Shia country in the region and the world for that matter, Iran and Assad-ruled Syria were a natural match. The new government, formed by the victorious rebel group Tahrir al-Sham, that's HTS, is militantly Sunni, hence no friend of either Shia Islam or Iran, and its leadership has made that clear. We should also understand that Turkey has been the longtime supporter of HTS, without whom HTS could never have accomplished the overthrow of Assad. Along with this reversal of polarity, we have seen the new government exercise restraint and tolerance toward minority groups such as Syrian Christians. In our view, this is not so much a reflection of inclusive values or anything like that, as it is a demonstration of the group's pragmatic attitude toward establishing and maintaining control. At any rate, initial indications suggest that the new government will uphold its primary loyalty to Turkey, develop constructive relations with other Sunni countries, especially Saudi Arabia, and align itself against Iran.
Well, let's get to the clear major winners and losers in all this. Who is the biggest loser?
Well, Phil, it's pretty clearly Iran. Assad was a decades-long supporter of the Iranian program for dominance in the region, a key member of the so-called axis of resistance, and a vital artery for the flow of soldiers, supplies, weaponry, and even finance for Iran's proxies from Lebanon to Gaza and beyond. In this overthrow, Iran did not just lose a friend, it gained an enemy.
How about Russia? What are its biggest concerns now in the aftermath of this regime change?
Well, Phil, back to a teeny bit of history. In the years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia retained a relationship with the Assad regime, and the main benefit for Russia was retention of its naval base at Tartus and air base at Khmeimim. Over the last 15 years or so, Russia has expanded its efforts to gain influence in both the Middle East and Africa, and it has extensively used these bases to support those efforts. Since the friendship between the Assad regime and the Russian leadership is well known, and since HTS and most of the Syrian population despised the ousted Assads, Russia might find it difficult to convince the new government to retain Russia's bases. Of course, the new government now finds itself faced with the immense challenge of rebuilding a war-torn country, and it will likely need all the financial assistance it can get. This might give the Russians an opportunity to make an offer that the Syrians don't refuse.
I was wondering, Daniel, could the collapse of Syria's government in any way hasten the end of the Ukraine war?
Phil, I just don't see this as having a meaningful impact on the events in Ukraine. Perhaps it will add just a little bit to Russia's existing difficulties and maybe tip the scales in Russia's calculus a little bit in the direction of wanting to achieve a negotiated cessation of the hostilities in Ukraine. However, the driving issues in that war are so large that I just don't see the turn of events in Syria as weighing enough on those scales to make a difference.
How about other neighboring countries like Israel? Does this strengthen Israel's military position?
Yes, Phil, it certainly does. While neither Israel nor the Assad regime had any interest in conflict with each other, Assad did give Iranian militant proxies broad latitude to operate in Syria. This meant Israel lived with the threat of a hostile force on its northeastern border. That force is gone. Beyond that, Israel took advantage of the overthrow of Assad to declare a 1974 treaty between the two countries to be void. That treaty prohibited Israel from occupying the Golan Heights, a strategically significant region on their shared border that Israel conquered in a previous war. Israel has now occupied the Golan, and for good measure, it launched more than 300 airstrikes against Syrian military assets throughout the country, along the way sinking what little navy Syria had.
Does all this make Turkey a bigger player in the Middle East?
Well, it certainly extends Turkey's reach. Turkey and the Assad regime were enemies of each other, so Turkey's geographic influence pushing southward ended at the border. Since Turkey fully sponsored HTS and likely gave the green light for the military operation that resulted in its ascent to power, we expect Turkey to have the dominant influence over the new Syrian government. This comes with several benefits, but I want to mention just one. Southeastern Turkey has a large Kurdish population, which forms part of the larger Kurdish population that kind of extends throughout that region from eastern Syria into northern Iraq and up into southeastern Turkey. The Kurds have long contended that they deserve an independent homeland, which naturally threatens the territorial integrity of all three of those countries. Turkey has long aspired to suppress Kurdish activism throughout the region, not just in its own southeast. Now that it has a client in Damascus, it may find itself with new levers in its contention with the Kurds.
Daniel, how is Saudi Arabia likely to react?
Back to a little bit of history again, Phil. Remember, and we talked about this in a previous report, that the Arabs, Persians, and Turks have been rivals of each other since ancient times, striving for regional dominance. More than once, Syria has been the battleground of this strife. As such, Saudi Arabia remains on its guard against any attempts by Turkey to reestablish the dominance that it enjoyed for centuries with the Ottoman Empire. That empire may have ended more than 100 years ago, but as we said earlier, it held sway over the region for more than 400 years. As much as Saudi Arabia sees the fall of Assad as a welcome blow to its Persian rival, remember, Persia and modern-day Iran are roughly the same thing, it sees the ascendance of a Turkish client as the potential replacement of one rival's loss with another rival's gain. We are already seeing Saudi Arabia greet the new government warmly, welcoming its representatives in Riyadh. We expect Saudi Arabia to use its abundant financial resources to curry favor in Damascus with lavish bids to assist the country's reconstruction.
Finally, how about those two giants on the international stage, the United States and China?
On the surface, China often seems less directly involved in the Middle East. However, China's economic relationships with both Iran and Saudi Arabia have grown in recent years, and the Iranian relationship now presents intriguing possibilities. In recent years, nearly 90% of Iran's crude oil exports have gone to China, with the share reportedly reaching nearly 100% in recent months. This is largely due to the effects of US and EU sanctions, which China evades. This gives China an extreme amount of economic leverage over Iran at the very time that Iran's fortunes and its economy have soured. We expect China to exploit the Syria situation to increase its leverage with Iran. Meanwhile, the United States has long been seeking to reduce its commitments in the Middle East to redirect its resources to counter its main threat, a rising China. We expect the Trump administration to place even greater emphasis on this shift, with the exception of Israel, which the U.S. will continue to staunchly support. U.S. policy may prove flexible and changing with other regional players. For instance, we do not necessarily expect the U.S. to continue to provide its historical levels of support to the Syrian Kurds. Rather, we expect the U.S. to support efforts to permanently degrade Iranian influence in Syria. That's always a priority, which implies constructive engagement with HTS in a bid to suppress Iran and foster regional stability.
Daniel, while this is a huge geopolitical event, does it change in any major way the confluence investment strategy?
Phil, the regime change in Syria shines yet another spotlight on a theme we have been emphasizing, global fracturing and bloc formation, which affects a whole host of asset classes. We expect downward pressure on long-term bond prices, upward pressure on commodities, a strong dollar, and higher and more volatile inflation. It's hard to predict how regime change in Syria will influence who gravitates toward which competing bloc. However, the suddenness of this change and the momentary power vacuum it has produced is spurring a scramble among regional and global players alike.
The strong dollar helps define the confluence's current cautionary position on foreign markets. But I'm wondering whether what's happened in Syria might cause at least some minor recalibration, maybe open up some opportunities. For instance, does Europe benefit if Syria's doors open to the return of refugees?
There certainly is a great deal of social and political pressure in many European countries to return the refugees to Syria. However, it is hard to say when or how quickly that could happen. We did see European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen go to Turkey, checkbook in hand, only 9 days after the change of power, with returning the refugees the only item on her agenda. Still, Syria has suffered the destructive effects of 13 long years of civil war. The country is not in a position to receive refugees in acceptable circumstances, so it might take quite a while for any of that to happen.
Do you think Turkey might gain some stature as an investment destination?
Yes, Phil, it might. That's a really good point. For a developing country, Turkey already has a diverse economy and a large investment universe. The country has had its share of recent struggles, such as high inflation. However, the long-term trends from an investor's perspective have on balance been positive, and any return of stability on its southern border could further benefit Turkey.
Thank you, Daniel. To our listeners, our discussion today is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. Also, this information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.